Welcome to the Thomistic Institute podcast. Our mission is to promote the Catholic intellectual tradition in the university, the church, and the wider public square. The lectures on this podcast are organized by university students at Thomistic Institute chapters around the world. To learn more and to attend these events, visit us at thomisticinstitute.org.
St. Thomas Aquinas, patron of students and a model of holiness. While 2023 marked the 700th anniversary of St. Thomas Aquinas' canonization in 1323, this year, 2024, marks the 750th anniversary of his death. This is then a double jubilee and a double opportunity to reflect on St. Thomas as not just a great teacher of truth and goodness from whom we can learn so much, but as a saint whose example of goodness, of virtue and holiness we are invited to follow. So as in my first talk, I gave seven reflections on Aquinas' ethics, on a Thomistic approach to the good life. So in this second talk, I'm going to structure my talk similarly by offering seven reflections on St. Thomas's life and how he can become, especially for our students, both our patron saint interceding for us and our exemplary model of holiness. So first, I'm going to speak about St. Thomas as our patron saint and intercessor in heaven and how we might get to know him. Second, about the highest faculties of St. Thomas's soul, his miraculous intellect, and even more striking, I would say, his indomitable will. Third, about St. Thomas's way of life, and in particular, roles of silence, solitude, and study. Fourth, about the works of St. Thomas that he's left us, his body of writings, the Corpus Thomisticum, and why St. Thomas is rightly called the universal, common, and angelic doctor of the Church. Fifth, about St. Thomas as a Dominican preacher and poet of the Christian faith. Sixth, to keep you interested, about St. Thomas's temptations on the cusp of his Dominican vocation, about his infamous abduction and seduction, and about the vital and essential role of prayer in his life. And then finally, I'm going to come full circle and reflect again on St. Thomas in heaven through Dante's depiction of him in Paradiso. So first of all, patron saint and intercessor. Proclaimed patron of all Catholic universities, academies, colleges, and schools in 1880 by Pope Leo XIII, St. Thomas Aquinas is, for Catholic university students and scholars, like many of us here, more than one saint among many. He is our very special and particular patron saint. While the remains of St. Thomas's physical body are preserved as relics on earth, and the body of his writings is available to all around the world online, the Corpus Thomisticum, St. Thomas's soul, which once informed his physical body and his corpus of writings, is, we believe, now alive at the very height of his powers in heaven, ready to help us in our own times. As our scholarly patron saint, we can ask St. Thomas for help with any difficulty, whether intellectual, a particular science problem or computer science problem, a particular essay crisis, or moral, say a struggle against temptation or distraction. Pictured in Christian iconography with the sun radiating from his heart, St. Thomas can light up our minds with truth and fire our hearts and wills with the virtues. How, though, can we get to know St. Thomas, our patron saint in heaven? How can he be more to us than the author of seemingly endless scholastic articles in the Summa Theologiae? In other words, who was the boy, the man, the Saint Thomas? Unlike Saint Augustine, Saint Thomas leaves us no confession, We have no personal or autobiographical insight into St. Thomas's own life of grace, his journey of sanctity from his birth around 1225 to his death on the 7th of March 1274. St. Thomas doesn't give us a glimpse in his writings into his personal life. He doesn't speak about himself. Indeed, he doesn't ever seem particularly interested in himself or in his own opinions, something I find quite refreshing in today's world. St. Thomas seems to disappear behind his works. His writings may seem rather impersonal, in seeking only the truth and to communicate it as clearly and concisely as possible. We easily lose sight of the personality of the truth seeker. St. Thomas's personal reticence and avoidance of speaking about himself speaks eloquently of one of his noted virtues, his lifelong humility, but it presents us with a problem. How can we find out who he was, this person whom we, as students, are invited to get to know, as a saint first and foremost, a friend, a brother, to whom we can turn in prayer? The 20th century English Dominican, Kenelm Foster, a Thomist and Dante scholar close to my own heart, seeks to answer this question in his helpful book, The Life of St. Thomas Aquinas Biographical Documents. Foster notes that all we know of St. Thomas the man, apart from his own writings, derives from three sources. First, minutes of the first canonization inquiry held in 1319. Second, three lives of St. Thomas written by Dominicans between 1318 and 1330. And third, a large section, 15 chapters, of Historia Ecclesiastica, written by another Dominican, Ptolemeo of Lucca, in 1317. So I've kind of drawn on that quite a bit in this talk. So now thinking about Aquinas' soul, his highest faculties, his miraculous intellect, and his indomitable will. We can certainly start, I think, by imagining St. Thomas as an intellectual prodigy, a kind of Mozart of the mind. Like Mozart's father, Leopold, who believed his son's musical talent to be a miracle, a gift from God, so Thomas, in later life, always attributed his extraordinary intellectual gifts to God, and understood the staggering fruits of his intellect in quantity more than 8 million words as works primarily of prayer and grace, as gifts, in other words, as gifts from God. Just as Leopold Mozart recognized it as his Christian duty to foster, nurture, and share the miracle of his son's talent with the world in order to convince through music a sceptical Enlightenment culture that, with Voltaire, ridiculed and denied all miracles of the truth of the Catholic faith, so St. Thomas's parents, recognizing his gifts, ensured he got the very best education then available, sending him at the age of 5 to the Benedictine Abbey of Monte Cassino, and aged around 14 to the newly established University of Naples, where he was said to make swift progress through the university curriculum, so grammar, logic, natural science, and all were astonished at his understanding. But however naturally gifted, however well taught, however graced, nobody gets anywhere without effort. There is some truth, after all, in Thomas Edison's aphorism that genius is 1% inspiration and 99% perspiration. Indeed, what strikes one particularly forcefully in reading through Thomas's biographical documents is not his intellect, however miraculous, but his will, his inflexible, dogmatic, impassioned, but imperturbable will. St. Thomas was a little boy, a youth, a man who knew what he wanted, who knew his own mind, and who was extremely single-minded. He was literally willful. And what St. Thomas, from his cradle to his grave, wanted, ardently desired, unwaveringly willed, was God. As a five-year-old boy at Monte Cassino, he would ask his perplexed teachers, but what is God, seeking always for greater knowledge? And when, towards the end of his life, having written about the God-man Christ in the Summa Theologiae, Christ appeared to him on the altar, saying, you have written well of me. What do you want as your reward? He answered, nothing except you, Lord. Nothing except you, Lord. In knowing so clearly what he wanted, St. Thomas, from his childhood on, would not let anything or anybody stand in his way in getting it. Such a clear vocation had consequences, in other words, not least for those around him. Thus, even as a little boy, Thomas reportedly shunned all frivolous conversation. He began to love solitude. He was a quiet boy, saying little, but already thinking much, rather silent and serious, and seemingly much given to prayer. As a child, Thomas thus modelled exactly the studious qualities he would later prescribe in a famous letter to a fellow Dominican who had asked him what he should do if he desired to become wise. Five of St. Thomas's precepts in this letter concern the student's need for silence and solitude, including to love your cell by making frequent use of it, and to be very familiar with nobody, for too much familiarity breeds contempt and inhibits study. In his early 20s, when Thomas was for some 6 to 7 years taken under the wing of St. Albert the Great in Cologne, he was so silent in class and so, we might say, introverted in lifestyle, that his fellow students mockingly called him the dumb ox from Sicily. Dumb, because always silent. Ox, because by constitution, tall and stout, from Sicily, as the kingdom of Naples in southern Italy, where he was from, was then also known. But Thomas's silence, his introversion, his love of his cell, of solitude, which must, to some of his fellow students, have felt like an affront, a lack of sociability, we can perhaps understand their frustration, their mockery of him, was for a purpose. It was to pursue most effectively the object of his unwavering will and of his Dominican vocation, knowledge of God by contemplation and sharing the fruits of that knowledge with others. On discovering St. Thomas's true ability, St. Albert famously prophesied, of course, we call this lamb a dumb ox, but I tell you that the whole world will one day hear his bellowing. St. Thomas's adulthood indeed appears as a life of never-ceasing study and teaching. It is not that Thomas did not sleep, eat, wash, go to the loo, travel. He was a human being like all of us. And it was not also that he was not forcibly interrupted from his study or teaching by administrative jobs, pastoral roles, or other urgent matters pertaining to his order, because he was. But crucially, like a compass needle that once still immediately fixes again on north, so Thomas's will, after each forcible interruption, appears always to have returned immediately to its primary object, God. So there are loads of anecdotes about Thomas, and I'm going to skip some of them, but you know, this sense of him being silent and insensible in company, about not being all there, about being absent-minded. I think we can see this as his will, always wanting to return to its primary object, to God and contemplation. So perhaps the most famous anecdote is when, against his will, he was ordered by his prior to accept the King, St. Louis of France's invitation to dinner. And in the middle of the feast, you'll all know this, Thomas, who'd been entirely lost in thought and hadn't touched his food, suddenly slammed the table, exclaiming, that settles the Manichees, only to be gently reminded that he was not in his cell, but at the king's table. So he's always just focused, always returning like a compass needle to contemplation. And that shows not just a miraculous intellect, because an intellect is an organ that we can choose to use. I think it shows, most importantly, his indomitable will. He knew what he wanted, and he was always returning, his will was always returning whenever possible to it. So finally then we move from the man, his capacities, his way of life, from the Catholic saint to the Catholic doctor of the church, and consider briefly, and what a task it is, St. Thomas's immense scholarly output. in the world of contemporary academia, where scholars tenaciously prize increasingly narrow fields of specialization, the range and depth of St. Thomas's works are simply breathtaking. Indeed, if St. Thomas More was a man full seasons, we might say that St. Thomas Aquinas was a scholar for all fields. He was a biblical scholar. He was a theologian. He was a philosopher. He was a Catholic apologist. He was a liturgist, a preacher, and a catechist. So as a biblical scholar, a master of the sacred page, Magister Sacrae Scripturae, St. Thomas lectured on the books of the Bible, including Old Testament commentaries on Isaiah, on Jeremiah and Lamentations, on Job, and on the Psalms. He wrote New Testament commentaries on Matthew, standing for the Synoptics, and on John, as well as on the Pauline epistles. And again, in the kind of canonization process, you get all these stories about St. Thomas, who was known to pray and weep and beg for the intercession of the very saints he was studying. So if Reginald's reports are believed, sometimes then these saints came to clarify their meaning, including on one occasion Saints Peter and Saint Paul. So they sort of come in person to Thomas and just explain this passage of the text that St. Thomas has been struggling with. So St. Thomas's biblical commentaries are not for the faint-hearted, though. His commentary on just the first four words of St. John's Gospel, in principio erat verbum, lasts for as many pages in a modern edition, with St. Thomas giving six meanings of the word principium, only one of which translates as our English equivalent, the beginning. So you're sort of thrown into the sea when you go into his biblical commentaries. Aquinas also wrote a compilation of the Latin and Greek fathers on the four Gospels, the Golden Chain, the Catena Aurea, a colossal work of scholarship, later translated into English under St. John Henry Newman's supervision. And again, I just say any attempt to set up Aquinas, the medieval scholastic, as somehow unbiblical or as against a resourcement of the fathers of the church fundamentally misrepresents then St. Thomas's teaching. For St. Thomas, scripture, Holy Scripture, provides the primary basis for all theological argument, while his patristic research is, in the words of the English Dominican Ada Nichols, staggering, placing him in the first rank in the history of positive, in other words, historical and patristic theology. St. Thomas is, of course, preeminently a theologian, and for good reason. I think this is important in terms of the relationship between his scriptural study and theology, and we've had a few discussions about that on this retreat already. As St. Thomas states, although the truth of faith is indeed contained in Holy Scripture, the 73 collected books of the Bible, it is contained there diffusely, sometimes obscurely, and under various modes of expression. The theologian's job, then, is to order revelation, the doctrine contained diffusely in all the books of the Bible, systematically, so as to present and teach it more effectively. So you can imagine having to go to a series of lectures on each of the 73 separate books contained in the Church's Library of Holy Scriptures. Right? That would take a lifetime. There would be masses of repetition because each lecture would cover similar doctrines multiple times and each time only partially and imperfectly. So the theologian draws together all the strands of scripture, and that was a task St. Thomas was particularly adept at, having memorized, it seems, most of the Latin Vulgate Bible and whole swathes of patristic scholarship. Aquinas then wrote a long commentary on the standard theological textbook of his day, the four books of Peter Lombard's Sentences. His theological masterpiece, though, is the Summa Theologiae, which, as I mentioned in my previous talk, brings together systematic theology, God, creation, Christology and the sacraments, and moral theology, the treatises on the vices and the virtues, into an innovative synthesis, which would become, by the 16th century, the measure, the rule, the Catholic theology, famously laid open on the altar alongside the Bible during the deliberations of the Church Fathers at the Council of Trent. So he's a biblical scholar, he's a theologian, he's also a philosopher. Although he never wrote a Summa Philosophiae, if only he had lived to do so, we might think, he died very young, He is also celebrated as an outstanding philosopher, writing numerous philosophical commentaries on the core philosophical textbooks of his day, including on Aristotle's Ethics, his Politics, his Natural Philosophy, his Anthropology and Metaphysics. St. Thomas also addressed particular philosophical problems in short treatises, including on the unity of the intellect against avarice and on the eternity of the world in a series of disputed questions. It was Aquinas' development of Aristotelian philosophy into what came to be called a philosophia perennis, or perennial philosophy, and his balance and synthesis of truths from reason and truths from faith, which Pope Leo XIII likewise championed in Aeterni Patris as a bulwark of the Catholic faith and as a powerful response to the problems and errors of much modern thought. He was also a Catholic apologist, and Aquinas engaged in a constructive dialogue with Jews, Muslims and non-believers, seeking to remove obstacles to Christian faith, predominantly through philosophical argumentation, most famously in his book on the truth of the Catholic faith against the errors of unbelievers, better known as the Summa Contra Gentiles. He also sought to engage with Greek Orthodox theologians in his scholarship on the Greek fathers, and he also wrote Contra Errores Grecorum, against the errors of the Greeks. Proclaiming him a saint in 1323, just under 50 years after his death, Pope John XXII declared, "Thomas of himself has enlightened the church more than all the other teachers and doctors of theology and philosophy." And in 1529, St. Thomas was the first teacher for 1,000 years and only the fifth saint to be given the title Doctor of the Church, the first four being the Latin doctors, St. Gregory the Great, Ambrose, Augustine, and St. Jerome. Since then, the Church's Magisterium has consistently celebrated St. Thomas as the common, universal and angelic doctor of the Church. As Pope Paul VI remarked in the second year of the Second Vatican Council, "Aquinas' doctrine is a treasure belonging not only to the Dominican order, but to the whole Church, and indeed to the whole world. It is not merely medieval, but valid for all times, not least of all our own." Or as Pope Pius XI had proclaimed on the sixth centenary of St. Thomas's canonization, "We now say to all such as are desirous of the truth, go to Thomas and ask him to give from his ample store the food of substantial doctrine wherewith to nourish your souls unto eternal life." Many who go to Thomas, however, quickly become overwhelmed. The oceanic size of Aquinas' works, the Summa Theologiae alone is 60 volumes in the Latin English Black Friars edition, is enough to put some off for life, and this is before confronting the question of difficulty or the unfamiliarity of St. Thomas's scholastic method. Moreover, some people appear to assume that St. Thomas, that great intellectual prodigy and master, makes impossible demands on ordinary Christians, as if every Christian were expected to try to dive straight into the Summa Theologiae and tread their way patiently through. However, this is emphatically not the case. St. Thomas's very first piece of advice to those seeking wisdom, the treasure of knowledge, is that you should choose to enter not straightway into the ocean, but by way of little streams, for difficult things ought to be reached by way of easier ones. In this light, I think, Aquinas' work as a liturgist, preacher, and catechist is especially important. Aquinas' office for the Feast of the Corpus Christi is a distillation, if you like, of his theology into poetry, a beautiful rivulet that all Catholics, young and old, imbibe. Aquinas' sermons, originally delivered in his local Neapolitan vernacular and then transcribed into Latin, on the Apostles' Creed, on the Lord's Prayer, on the Ten Commandments, are truly little streams of God's wisdom intended for and accessible to all Christians. Secondly, and relatedly, St. Thomas actually places a minimal level of knowledge of the Catholic faith, as I said, summed up in the Apostles' Creed, as necessary for Christian salvation. And he thinks this knowledge of God, the knowledge available just in the Apostles' Creed, is greater than all the knowledge gained by the philosophers of old, Aristotle included. As he writes at the beginning of his Compendium of Theology, "What the Word taught at great length although clearly throughout the various volumes of sacred scripture for those who have leisure to study, he has reduced to brief compass for the sake of those whose time is taken up with the cares of daily life. So we might say that for Thomas, the Apostles' Creed is like the earth seen from space. Right? So as from space, one truly sees the whole earth, even though simply and in no great detail. So it is truly the case that in the Apostles' Creed, we really do see all the doctrines of the Christian faith. And we might say the Nicene Creed brings one ever so slightly closer to earth, as to counter heretical opinions, it contains more explicitly what the Apostles' Creed contains implicitly. And we might say Aquinas' sermons on the Apostles' Creed and his beautiful compendium of theology are like viewing the earth or viewing various countries and seas of the earth from an aeroplane. So you're much closer. You can start seeing the territory of the faith as it's unpacked and surveyed in more detail. Whereas to read one article at random from Aquinas' Summa Theologiae is like being dropped into the middle of a teeming city or a dense jungle, seeing things up front at ground level, but really in the microcosmic. And then he has his disputed questions, which are even more microscopic, which is like, I would say, analyzing a plant through a microscope. So in these specialized and technical works, we're exploring particular doctrines of the faith in all their richness, depth, and complexity. I think that's quite important just to realize that, you know, sometimes people just go straight to the Summa and think, right, that's Aquinas. But no, that's the specialist bit. That's when you're down in the nitty-gritty. But there's also Aquinas who's going to give you a whole beautiful panorama of the faith. He's just going to give you a simple sermon on the whole of the Apostles' Creed. And often that's the best way to start. To venerate St. Thomas as a doctor of the Church does not imply then that we should all read all the Summa Theologiae or follow his vocation as a philosopher and theologian. Just as we can all enjoy listening to Mozart while not all trying to become composers. Many are the paths to heaven and diverse the flowers of the saints. And St. Thomas's teaching of the Catholic faith flows to us through many different channels, from the Corpus Christi liturgy to the various catechisms of the Church. To blame, though, St. Thomas for the length and complexity of some of his works is, I think, unfair. It's rather like blaming Mozart or Haydn for writing too many or too complex pieces of music. St. Thomas sought to understand the infinite expanse and depth of God's wisdom, Haydn and Mozart to convey God's glory in music, and no work of theology, however long and detailed, could ever contain such a thing, nor any piece of music fully do it justice. We're getting there. Abduction, seduction, and prayer. By now you're perhaps thinking, haven't I skipped all the juicy parts of St. Thomas's tale? His violent abduction, his imprisonment for almost 2 years, and his infamous trials and temptations. I've gone on and on about Thomas being studious, silent, solitary, stocky, stout, about St. Thomas's Summa Theologiae, Summa Contra Gentile, Sententiae commentaries, about the little streams of his sermons. But what about the great S, the great seduction? To return then from the works of the doctor to the life of the saint, although at a certain stage these become, as we've seen, almost the same thing, there is indeed a dramatic break and interlude occurring between Thomas's childhood and adolescence in southern Italy and his public vocation as a Dominican student and teacher in the bastions of European learning in Cologne, Paris, and Rome. A time, like Jesus's 40 days in the desert, of isolation, temptation, and the testing of his vocation. Thomas had encountered the relatively new order of the Dominicans, founded some 10 years before his birth, in Naples, and he received the Dominican habit in his late teens, perhaps at 19. Today, we might think it strange that parents who had desired their son become a Benedictine monk would be so upset that he upsticks to become a Dominican. Thomas's parents, however, were leading nobles in southern Italy, and their intention was for him to become not any old monk, but like his uncle before him, the abbot of Monte Cassino, with jurisdiction over considerable lands and wealth. The idea that their noble little Thomas would become a mendicant, literally a beggar, and they really did beg in those days. Begging on the streets from commoners was, it seems, too much for St. Thomas's aristocratic family to stomach. This led then to Thomas's flight to Paris and his violent capture by his soldier elder brothers serving with the Emperor Frederick II. Reportedly, the soldiers first tried to get Thomas to take off the Dominican habit and put on some proper clothes, but Thomas, though no soldier, a strong, stocky man, refused, and in the end they furiously bundled Thomas onto a horse while he clutched stubbornly to his Dominican rags, which I think is quite a nice image. Thomas's family then imprisoned him for some 18 months to 2 years, and in the family castle, slightly echoing the words of the canonization literature there, his brothers in the flesh reportedly tried all attempts to break Thomas's resolve to remain with the Dominicans, his brothers in the spirit. Most infamously, that no temptation be left untried, they introduced, again I quote, a lovely but shameless girl into Thomas's prison cell to seduce him. What might we glean then of Thomas's character from this seduction temptation, as later reported by his Dominican companion, secretary and confidant, Reginald? And in the narratives of his temptations, they kind of build up to this one, the crescendo, which probably has a sort of rhetorical motive behind it. So what happened? So ambushed by a naked girl in his cell, Thomas, as entirely natural for a young man, was sexually aroused. Instead of assenting to this vehement desire, his, I quote, wise and virile soul quickly controlled it, for, quote, only in the flesh was he adolescent. And as if to demonstrate his heroic control over not just the natural desires for sexual pleasure, but also over our natural fear of sensual pain, Thomas then reportedly picked up a burning log from the fire, driving out the temptress, the bearer of lust fire, and etching on the wall of his cell the sign of the cross. Then Thomas reportedly fell to the ground weeping and begging God to grant him the gift of constant virginity and praying that what he had done he would have the strength to do always. But once human and heroic, we witness again here, I think, Thomas's forceful, indomitable will and his combative spirit fighting against every temptation. As you probably know, St. Philip Neri, in a similar predicament, so he'd been lured into the room of a famous Roman courtesan who was naked but for a thin veil. St. Philip Neri made the sign of the cross and then fled the room. He said it's better to flee temptation than to risk facing it. So I think it's a lovely sort of human thing about St. Philip Neri. But with nowhere to flee, I mean, he's imprisoned, Thomas had no option but to confront his temptation. He couldn't run away from it. And he had to confront his temptress head on. At the same time, we're invited to imagine St. Thomas as a young man really struggling with temptation, recognizing his own weakness, the force of his sexual desires, his need for God's help. And at the end of his life, he told his secretary, Reginald, that his prayer had been answered and that two angels bound him with a girdle of chastity such that he was never troubled again in his life by sexual temptations. So alongside his humility, his studiousness, St. Thomas is thus renowned for his purity of heart. And as many of you know, there's a special confraternity of the Dominicans for the pursuit of chastity with St. Thomas and the Blessed Virgin Mary as its patrons. And as Pope Pius XI put it, if St. Thomas had not been victorious when his chastity was in peril, it is very probable that the Church would never have had her angelic doctor. So it's a very beautiful episode, I think, you know, before his public ministry. He has this moment of all these temptations and he really shows his utter dependence on prayer, as well as, you know, his extraordinary will, that he knew what he wanted. He wouldn't let anything, any temptation oppose his will, his love for God. St. Thomas's imprisonment was a time of trial, but as typical, he also used this forced period of solitude for study, memorizing, it is supposed, much of the Latin Vulgate Bible from memory. And Thomas would face many, many further trials in his academic life, including the attempts in Paris to prohibit the mendicant orders even from teaching in the university a truly existential threat for the Dominicans given the order's vocation to study in truth. In his works, Thomas would also combat the errors of philosophers and theologians and would struggle to understand the most subtle problems in philosophy, to pierce with understanding the most difficult mysteries of revealed truth, fighting like his spiritual master, St. Dominic, for his lady, the Catholic faith. And I think, again, when you read the biographical documents, I really recommend it because, you know, they really present St. Thomas a bit like Father Matthew was saying, as of simple heart. So he would do very simple prayers, you know, sort of famous one of him being on a ship and it looked like he was going to be drowned. He gets really upset and he does the sign of the cross. It was very sort of simple piety to St. Thomas. Through his whole life, including his times of trial, we witness Thomas's stubborn and inflexible will, which like a magnet always returned him to God, to the first and great commandment, thou shalt love the Lord thy God with all thy heart, with all thy soul, and with all thy mind. Thomas's sister Marotta, whom he converted when imprisoned and who later became a nun, asked him what she must do to become a saint. And Thomas reportedly replied with just one word, velle, will it. If you want to become a saint, will it. And the emphasis on willing. All Catholics strive to become saints, to be with God in heaven. And it is comforting that for St. Thomas, this may involve times of trial. It may call for heroic holiness, but the path remains clear. To become a saint, we must will to become a saint. And like St. Thomas, persist in that will, knowing that God, by his grace, will provide everything else we need on our journey. If on our journey to God, we seek to know him better, the soul of St. Thomas, our patron saint in heaven, is waiting to help, while never before have so many of his writings or so many Thomistic resources, and I think exemplary resources are provided by the Thomistic Institute online, never before have so many of these been so readily available to us. So in this talk, I've tried to give a sense of St. Thomas the man, the saint, as well as a glimpse of his extraordinary, that is miraculous, achievements as a doctor of the Church. For a beautiful poetic portrait of St. Thomas in heaven, though, we need go no further than Divine Comedy of his contemporary Dante. So Dante was 9 when St. Thomas died. Dante gives St. Thomas Aquinas the place of preeminence in his heaven of Christian wisdom and affords St. Thomas more words in his poem than to any other character, save Beatrice, who symbolizes the supernatural order, and Virgil, who symbolizes the natural order. St. Thomas is for Dante the theologian par excellence, who brings together into an incomparable synthesis the truths of reason, the natural order, and of faith, the supernatural order. In Dante's Paradiso, St. Thomas's speech opens by assuring Dante character. So Dante is the author of the poem, but he's also the main character in the poem as a pilgrim through the three regions of the medieval afterlife. St. Thomas's speech opens by assuring Dante that to ask for wisdom from him is to receive. Whoever should deny the wine of his flask to your thirst would not be free except as water not descending to the sea. We have only to ask, only to open the book, and there it is. And St. Thomas introduces himself humbly as one of the lambs of the holy flock that Dominic leads by a path and as the brother and student of Albert of Cologne. Let me close then my own prosaic talk by quoting from the end of St. Thomas's speech in Dante's poem, reading Dorothy Sayers' quite free translation, which keeps Dante's poetic terzerima rhyme scheme. In his final speech, Dante's St. Thomas, with homely and down-to-earth examples. So that's what I feel about St. Thomas, his sort of homely down-to-earthness. St. Thomas counsels caution and patience in seeking the truth, as well as, crucially, in judging others. For lo, among the dunces is his place, who hastens to accept or to reject, with no distinction made twixt case and case. Thence come rash judgments, mostly incorrect, and prejudiced, and stubborn all the more that self-conceit shackles the intellect. Worse than in vain does any quit the shore to fish for truth, the fisher's art, unknowing, he'll not return the man he was before. No one should ever be too self-assured in judgment, like a farmer reckoning his gains before the corn crop is matured. For I have seen the briar, a prickly thing, and tough the winter through, and on its tip, bearing the very rose at close of spring. And once I saw her whole long ocean trip safe done, a vessel wrecked upon the bar, and down she went, that swift and stately ship. Let Jack and Jill not think they see so far, that, seeing this man pious, that a thief, they see them such as in God's sight they are, for one may rise, the other come to grief. Thank you.
Thanks for listening to this lecture on the Thomistic Institute podcast. The generosity of people like you makes this podcast possible. If you enjoy these talks, please consider showing your support at www.thomisticinstitute.org/donate. Your donation of even a dollar helps us reach more college students and many others with the powerful truths of the faith, and it ensures that we can keep publishing top-notch lectures on this podcast. Thanks a lot.